Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Last weekend I taught a meditation retreat, and this week there are lots of people missing because they're at the 10-day retreat with Acham Brahm. So tonight I thought I'd talk a little bit about meditation, using some of the questions from the meditation retreat last weekend, because they cover a lot of the ground that everyone goes through as they try to establish their meditation practice and try to understand where meditation fits in to the Buddhist path. In fact, one of the first questions that I'd like to talk on was a question someone asked about: if you don't get your meditation together, then is there any point in practicing the Buddhist path? Because the Buddhist path seems to emphasize so much meditation, and you really need to have some good results in meditation so that you can do all the other things that you need to do. And if you can't get your meditation together, is it worth going on? They are obviously having some less than pleasant experiences in their meditation. It wasn't quite as blissful or easeful as they were hoping. But the answer to this is that meditation is only one part of the path of practice. It's a very important part, and that's why we encourage all of you, everyone, to start to learn meditation and to develop it, and that's why we have meditation retreats. But the fact is that most Buddhists in the world don't meditate. Most Buddhists don't have meditation as their focal point, but they still derive tremendous benefit from practicing the Buddha's teachings. So even if we don't ever get round to meditating, as many, many Buddhists don't, there is still a lot to be gained just by having the guidance on how to live an ethical lifestyle, how to develop an ethical lifestyle, and the benefits that come from that for one's own peace of mind, one's own the improvement in one's relationships, one's social relationships, and one's relationship with the world. Buddhism is very strong on this ethical lifestyle and the benefits that it brings. The Buddha said that when one can look back on one's behaviour and rejoice in it, have no regret about it, that is a source of happiness in the mind, that is a source of contentment, and that alone is wonderful. So just following the five precepts, and particularly the first one, to live as harmlessly as possible, is a wonderful support for the mind. And if you're like me, you've struggled to find out how to live in this world in the most beneficial way, the most harmless way, knowing that we can't possibly exist without it being at the expense of some beings or other. So, for example, when we clear the ground to plant our food, Many insects, many animals are disturbed by that. So it's impossible to live in the world without it being at the expense of other beings. So how can we minimize the harm that we do? And the Buddha's teachings help us to work with that. So when we take the precepts, it's not that we expect that we will never ever again harm another being. But how can we start to be more careful, more thoughtful about what we do? And one of the things that our practice encourages us to do is always to consider the consequences of our thought, speech and action. To start to be aware of the fact that everything that we do has an effect. And once we become consciously aware of that, we practice to become aware of the effects, the consequences of what we're doing, and to see what results from the choices that we make, and to bring that back to how can I minimize harm, how can I maximize benefits to myself and others. And even just following this line of practice, we start to see how connected we are to the other people and the other beings with whom we share this world. So if I do harm to others, I also cause harm to myself, because if I act heedlessly, thoughtlessly, there already has to be this strong degree of self-centeredness present in the mind. There has to be this strong degree of aversion in the mind to just act without thinking about the effect that it has on others. And when we start to pay attention to how it feels when we're off the rails, when we're completely heedless and self-centered, it's a very miserable state of being. And we start to see that if we're operating from that miserable state of being, that's the effect that we're creating, and that's going to come back to us. That's what we're going to get back in our own life. And so even if we're not meditating, if we're applying the teachings that we've heard, if we're investigating, we'll start to see these things for ourselves. And so the other thing that Buddhism helps us to see, even before we start to meditate, is where our true happiness lies. The Buddha never said that the material aspects of our life are unimportant. He recognized that even monks and nuns who live the monastic life need to have the four requisites of food, shelter, clothing and medicine in order to practice the spiritual life. So for lay people, this is an important area of your life and where you put a lot of effort and energy. But in terms of the teaching, the Buddha encouraged us to reflect, where does our true happiness lie? Does it lie in material things? Does it lie in things that are always going to be just temporary? Where do we find true happiness? And if we investigate that, we recognize that it's because of our connection and our connectedness with others, our relationships, particularly with the people that we're closest to, this is where we find our true fulfillment and satisfaction. And so Buddhism helps us to prioritize our life. What are the things that we need to give more attention to? What are the things that we need to really develop? And not to deny that we need to put effort and energy into the material aspects, but to realize the limitations of that and to give priority to the development of our own heart and the development of relationships with the people, particularly the people who are closest to us. And this is all before we get to meditation. And then when we hear the teachings and we start to take them in, there are some seminal teachings of the Buddha that really we can use again and again to help to make the most of every day. And one of the teachings that comes up again and again is the teaching on the certainty of our death, the certainty of impermanence, that having been born, all of us are old enough to die at this moment. And as we really have that hammered into us again and again, rather than making us miserable, we see this is a fact of life, can't be denied. And if we understand that life is temporary, that the time of our death is uncertain, only that it will happen is certain, then it encourages us to make the most of what we've got, of the time that we have, of the relationships that we're in, to really recognize how precious they are and how fragile this life is. And all of these things actually add to the quality of our life long before we get down to meditation. So if I asked everyone in this room how many people meditate every day, how many people give priority to their meditation over everything else that they have to do, very few would be able to say, well, no, every day I meditate no matter what, and I recognize really how important it is, because that's where most of us are at. Still haven't gotten to the point where meditation is central to our life. But even before that point, there is so much to be gained from following the Buddha's teachings. Now, having said that meditation is just a part of the path, it obviously is an integral part if we want to go further, if we really have the aspiration to become enlightened. And enlightenment simply means to wake up to the true nature of things, to live life fully because we understand life completely. And as I said, that can include living, making the most of this moment because we realize how precious it is. In the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the guidelines for our practice, meditation is the part of the path which follows on from development of virtue and morality, and is the part of the path in which we look directly at the mind. And in the meditation tonight, when we were looking at the breath, we were trying to develop that ability to witness the breath, observe the breath, just as a phenomenon, just as a process, breathing in and breathing out. And the same with our thinking. When the mind wandered away from the breath because there was thinking going on, thoughts were arising, thoughts were carrying us away from the present moment. When the mind was distracted because of sounds going on or because of aches and pains in the body and the attention went to those things, we're trying to develop the ability to just know that without judgment, without making it good or bad, just simply to observe as a witness, thinking. Or to observe that the mind has wandered away, and to move the mind back is again developing that observing, witnessing quality which is called mindfulness or sati. And the aspect of mindfulness that is a further development of that is sampajanya, to know what is going on. So first of all, we know that the mind has moved away to thinking. And then with sampajanya, we know that it's thinking about the past, or it's thinking about the future, or there are happy thoughts, or there's planning. So we know what is going on, and we allow that to be, but we let it go and come back to the breath. The more that we're able to pay attention to the breath, or to whatever meditation object we've taken up, the more we can develop or strengthen that quality in the mind to be able to watch as an observer, to see what's going on. And in the part of the Noble Eightfold Path that is about looking directly at the mind, the part that is called right effort is about looking directly at the mind and seeing whether the kind of thoughts that are taking place, that are present, are helpful or unhelpful, whether they lead to our happiness or to our misery. And through understanding that, through witnessing first of all, recognizing, and then knowing this is not for our benefit, this is for our harm, to move the mind away, to replace an unhappy thought, an unskillful thought, with a wholesome thought. And if we don't have any happy thoughts to replace an unhappy thought with, we can learn to replace that thought with attention on the breath, coming back to something which is neutral, which is actually soothing for the mind. And that's why when we practice meditation and we become skilled at putting our attention on the breath, moment after moment, we're actually developing a tool which we can use in our everyday life. When the mind gets worried, when the mind gets angry, when we find ourselves lost in miserable thoughts, as soon as we know that, we let go of the thoughts and we put our attention on the breath. We make much of the breath and we find that the mind calms down. Watching the breath is soothing and we actually help to support the mind to be happy. Even though we haven't put an obviously happy thought in there, just the fact that we're not feeding the negativity, just the fact that we're providing the mind with something that is neutral, will allow the mind to find its own happiness. In the part of the Noble Eightfold Path that is to do with meditation, we have right effort, right mindfulness, this witnessing quality, and right concentration or right samadhi. And this is what most people think of as meditation. They think that meditation, a good meditation, is when the mind is able to focus continuously on an object, a wholesome object like the breath, and by being able to stay with that object, to enter into a state of peace, calm, eventually bliss. Now this is one description of meditation, and in the scriptures of Buddhism, the Buddha mentions again and again that to be able to access these deep states of peace and stillness, these deep states of calm and bliss, this is correct meditation. But on the path to reaching that point, there are many staging points, if you like, before we get to that point. And even when we get to that point, we have to understand that the experience of a blissful, peaceful mind in itself is not enough. That experience has to be understood. It has to be understood that this is pointing to the nature of the mind itself. And when we understand the nature of the mind itself, it has to lead to a change in the way that we live our ordinary life. So although meditation is very important, the way that we define meditation generally is very narrow. We don't have a complete understanding of what meditation is if we think that it is just this peaceful, blissful experience. What we are trying to develop in the meditation practice is the ability to observe, be awake to, start to understand the way the mind works. When we try to do this, initial attempts usually come from an attempt to make my mind, when we're thinking about ourselves, my mind more peaceful, so that I can be more calm, so that I can be happier, so that I can cope with my life better, so that I can understand my problems, so that I can sort out my life, my relationships. When we first approach meditation, we are looking through the prism, if you like, the viewfinder of me and mine, my mind. And the way that we approach our meditation is in terms of what I would like to get out of the meditation for me. We're looking at it in a very personalized, specific way. And so if we have the idea that we want our mind to become peaceful and calm so that I can feel more at ease, so that I can feel happier, we will judge our meditation as good or bad depending on whether we can achieve those states. And if we have that view, then we will say that when the mind is not peaceful and calm, when there are thoughts coming up that disturb me, when I can't get my mind to stay on the breath, that's a bad meditation. There's something wrong. My meditation isn't good. And I'm not able to meditate, basically. That's what we often end up saying. We get discouraged because we have this idealized goal that only when the mind is completely peaceful and blissful is it a real meditation. But in fact, if we understand that what we're trying to do is to get to know the mind, first of all, to get to know our own mind, because that's what we're most interested in, and then to get to know not just our own mind, but the nature of everyone's mind through understanding our own, then it doesn't make it a bad meditation because the mind is caught up in thinking or wandering away. What we start to learn is that this mind, which I thought was under my control, which I thought I was thinking the thoughts that I choose to think, is actually produced through whatever I'm influenced by. We say whatever I'm causes and conditions are acting on the mind at this time. So if you have been having a very nice life and things were going well for you, it's likely that when you sit down to meditate, your mind is quite happy and quite energized. If you've been going through difficult times, then it's likely that when you sit down and try to meditate, those difficult times will come into the mind as thoughts, as agitation, as worries. And even if you try to watch the breath, you won't be able to force the mind to do that because of the effect of what the mind has been exposed to in your ordinary everyday life. Now, if we are just trying to stop our mind from thinking and be blissful, then we'll be disappointed, and we very often get into a battle with the thoughts. But if we are wanting to understand what produces the mind in any moment, what gives rise to our experience right now, and we develop that ability to observe what is going on in the mind without judgment, without interfering, just observing, then we will see cause and effect. Because the mind's been exposed to this thing, the effect is these sorts of thoughts arise again and again. We start to see the connection between the way that we live our ordinary life, the things that are going on in our life, and what is going on in our mind. Not just in the meditation, we realize this is what's happening all the time. But in the meditation, we're getting a chance to see it clearly. And to see it clearly is the first step. When we are increasing this ability just to observe the breath, instead of getting lost in the thinking, instead of getting overwhelmed by the emotions that arise with the thoughts, as we keep watching, as we keep focusing on the meditation object, what happens is that we don't feed the thoughts. And because we don't feed them, they start to lose their energy. If we're battling with the thoughts, we actually increase them. The battle itself feeds them. But withdrawing from them, going back to the neutral breath, we don't feed the thinking, and the mind eventually calms down. The thoughts get less and less. The ability to stay on the meditation object gets stronger and stronger. Now, for most people, the thoughts don't go away completely, but they lose their strength, they lose their power to overwhelm the mind. And particularly as we continue to practice regularly, the strength of our mindfulness and the ability to hold on to the meditation object gets stronger. And even in the midst of turmoil, we can always find some refuge by going back to the breath. Not only do we find some refuge, but we're able to observe what's going on in the mind and see the connections to our life, and understand that the mind is, as the Buddha described it, not me, not mine, but conditioned by what it is exposed to. And one of the things that we're exposing it to deliberately through our meditation practice is mindfulness, is that ability to observe what is going on, to stay in a neutral frame of mind and not get swept away by what is happening. If we continue to develop that quality, that mindfulness, and we're able to stay with the meditation object for longer stretches of time, then we certainly will come to a point where the mind becomes peaceful and calm, where it becomes still, simply focusing on the meditation object. It won't get pulled away by thoughts or sounds or feelings in the body. It will stay focused, and being able to stay focused will naturally give rise to a peaceful feeling. And as we go further, that peaceful feeling becomes a blissful feeling. And as we go further, that blissful feeling becomes a feeling of great happiness. So the meditation that we've idealized, the idea of this is the real meditation, is something that we're working towards. But we need to understand that the journey to that point is ripe with the opportunity to understand the mind and to understand ourselves. So as I said, we first of all filter everything through the prism of me and mine. So the thoughts that are arising in the mind are to do with me and my situation, to do with my past and my future and my likes and my dislikes. And we spend a lot of time in our meditation trying to sort out our life situation. And particularly if we aren't keeping our ordinary life up to scratch morally, ethically, we'll find that there will be constantly be worries and things which agitate us because we're not living a wholesome, skillful life. But if we start to clean up our thought, speech and action in our daily life, that will certainly conduce to our mind being free of worry, free of anxiety when we sit down to meditate. And we'll see the benefits of that ethical lifestyle carrying over into our meditation. And we start to understand how that carries over back into our ordinary everyday life. The mind that we are working with in our meditation continues into our daily life. So we no longer think that we can separate our spiritual life from our ordinary mundane life. It's all one, whether we're on the cushion or off the cushion, whether with our spiritual friends or with our ordinary friends. It's all one. We're carrying it with us in our heart. First of all, we are seeing it all through the prism of self and starting to understand what gives rise to our own states of mind, our own emotional reactions, how they play themselves out in our relationships and bring us into harmony or conflict with the people around us. And then eventually we start to recognize that what is happening for each of us individually is happening for everyone, because this is a universal phenomenon. This is the way the mind works, not just my mind, everyone's mind. We're all in the same boat. And this is how we start to generalize our understanding, and how we use what we've gained for understanding ourselves to help in understanding others and improving our relationship with others. Because we recognize the things that trigger anger in me and the way that anger gets out of control and the way it keeps coming and biting me and the way that it keeps being fed. The way that it happens for me, that's what happens for everyone. And not just with anger, with all the emotions, with all the states of mind that arise. They're all happening in the same way for everyone else. And it's not just enough to pacify the mind in meditation. We have to take that out into our ordinary life. When we start to work in this way, when we come to our meditation, we're not surprised to see our ordinary life evident in the way the mind is at this moment in our meditation. We're not surprised that there are things happening in our meditation which mirror what's been going on in our daily life. But now we start to develop the skills to work with those things in our meditation so that they can help us to go back into our daily life with more calm, more compassion, more wisdom. One of the things that comes through our practice is the ability to take control of our mind, to take control of our thoughts and take control of our emotions. That's because when they arise, we are able to observe them as a witness, notice the effect, but to resist their push to dictate how we speak and act. A very good example of this came from someone in the meditation retreat on the weekend. Someone who's an experienced meditator, and because of their experience, was able to work very skillfully in the retreat with a mind which was very agitated. This person is a very good person, has been keeping precepts for a long time, practicing generosity and goodness, the sort of person who goes out of their way to be helpful. And with all of that, in their life at the moment, there are a lot of unwanted things happening. Ill health, accidents, unhappiness with people that they're closely associated with, people they're closely connected with, and a lot of things happening out of their control. And so when they came to the meditation retreat, they were thinking, oh, I just really need a break. And they were looking forward to a nice, blissful meditation because they've had blissful meditations before. But in the context of what's been happening in their life, that wasn't what happened. And so they said that their mind was just going crazy while I was sitting there trying to watch the breath. Now, they're used to watching the breath and they've been able to watch the breath and get into peaceful states in the past, but not at the moment because there's just too much happening. And because there's been too much happening and too much unpleasantness, when they would sit down to meditate, all that unpleasantness would hit them in the face, and so they would decide, oh, I can't sit in meditation now, I'll give it a bit of a break. And so they hadn't been keeping up with their practice either. So when they sat down in the meditation retreat, that were also, again, hit in the face, but because of being in the retreat situation, it wasn't so easy to get up and walk away. And so after trying to stay with their breath unsuccessfully, they recognised this mind is the result of what's been going on in recent times. And it is useless to battle with the thoughts and emotions that are coming up and trying to make them go away. So I'm going to make a pact with my mind. And I'm going to set up the conditions for the meditation. And so they said to their mind, okay, mind, there are three things that you can pay attention to. You can pay attention to sounds when they happen around you, around. If you hear a sound, you simply can pay attention to it, hearing, 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 paying attention to the sound until it ceases. That's the first thing you can pay attention to. You can pay attention to thinking, but only just to notice that the mind is lost in thinking. As soon as you realise that we're not watching the breath, thinking, thinking, thinking until the thought finishes and then back to the breath. And also, mind, you can pay attention to any feelings in the body. pleasant feelings, unpleasant feelings. If the mind wanders to the body, okay, pay attention as long as that feeling is there until it ceases, and then back to the breath. Any of those three things. And if you're not watching the breath, okay. But as long as you're watching one of those things and not getting lost in all of the confused and unhappy thoughts that were sweeping over the mind. And so they said the whole weekend that was what they did. They were either observing hearing, they were observing thinking, or they were observing feelings in the body. And they said it was hard work. And they never got to a point where there was peace and quiet. But they didn't lose the balance of their mind. That quality, that ability to observe, was what they strengthened. And they said, strangely enough, before I came to the meditation retreat, I had such an ache in my hip and such an ache in my knee. And I'd thought to myself, oh dear, this is going to be hard work with these pains on the weekend. And guess what? The pains went away. And they said, strangely enough, even though the whole weekend was just observing these three things and there was not a bit of peace and quiet, after the meditation retreat finished, I felt so relaxed. I felt so energized. I was just amazed because the result was not what I had expected, not what I thought it was going to be, because I wasn't sitting in this blissful, peaceful state. Now, this is a very good example of how someone who is skilled at knowing the mind can turn their understanding to good effect. Instead of thinking, this is a bad meditation, I'm hopeless this weekend, I can't make my mind be quiet, they recognised, of course the mind can't be quiet. What do you expect after all we've been through in the last little while? But I do have a tool that I can use that can help me, and that is the tool of mindfulness. I can't watch the breath because the breath doesn't have enough oomph to grab me, to grab the attention, but I can watch these objects, which are very juicy objects at the moment. And that's what they did. So that quality of attention, awareness, that ability to observe what's going on, that is actually what we're trying to strengthen. And if we're able to strengthen that, there does come a point when, because we're not feeding the agitation in the mind does calm down and eventually finds peace. Now, if that person had been sitting through a 10-day retreat, it's no doubt that there would have come a time when the thoughts would have really calmed down. But again, that's not permanent. When we get back into our daily life situation, if we get into a difficult situation, then the mind will be fired up again. So this is a process that goes on and on. It's not something that we expect to be permanent. If we get to a place where there's peace and quiet, we enjoy it. We allow it to refresh the mind. And we recognize that when we get to that point of calm and stillness, tremendous clarity arises in the mind. We can see things clearly, sometimes for the first time, because we're not so invested in it, me and mine. We start to see the characteristics of the mind, not just in terms of me as the center, at the center of it. We start to understand things beyond our personal situation. And this is where insight arises, the wisdom aspect of the path, which is the third aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. This wisdom only arises from a silent mind, from a clear, calm mind, from a strong, still mind. And that is what we are working towards. But not just the experience of that calm, clear mind. That alone is not enough. We have to use that clarity, that strength, as a platform to investigate our experience, to investigate what life is throwing at us, and eventually to investigate it not just in terms of how life is treating me or what's happening to me, but to see it in its universality. So to go back to the beginning of my talk, the teaching on death, the teaching on impermanence. First of all, we're looking at it as my death, or what's happened to me, the thing that's changed that I don't like, or the thing that I've lost personally. But then eventually we start to recognize this is an experience that everyone has. This is part of being human. And then we start to be able to see change not just when it manifests in a gross way, but when it's happening moment after moment after moment in this body and in this mind. And because we understand it, because we see it clearly, because we have this insight into the reality of change, eventually we start to accept it. We start to be able to live with it rather than fight against it. And this is where we find the deepest level of peace, the true peace that comes from the wisdom aspect of the path. Seeing the truth of the Buddha's teachings in our own experience. This is what really liberates us. So until that point, whenever we meditate, we always have the opportunity to learn something about ourselves, to learn something about how the mind functions, what produces our experience in this moment. So no meditation is ever a bad meditation, as long as we approach it with that idea of what can I learn from this experience, what can I learn from this meditation. And if we are working towards strengthening that ability to observe whatever's arising, whether we like it or not, we'll be heading in the right direction. We'll be heading in the direction of true peace. So I encourage all of you to continue to develop the path, wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, but always to remember that the path in its entirety is comprised of both of sila, virtue, samadhi, direct development of the mind, and panya, the wisdom aspect which leads to liberation. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may the fact that you've come here today to cultivate this path help all of you to continue to grow in Dharma, and may this merit help us all to attain Nibbana. Now, does anyone have any questions about anything that I've said? Yes. The peace that allows us to just be with things, can we actually create that, or does it just arise and breaks in? Is that basically? We do create it. We create it by manifesting all the causes and conditions that help to increase the wholesomeness in the mind and reduce the unwholesomeness. But we can't always anticipate when what we've been doing is going to bear fruit in the way that we would like it to. And that is the peace that allows us to not follow our old habit patterns, for example, in a situation, to see things in a completely new way than we'd never seen it before. We can't manufacture that or produce that instant or that moment of breakthrough. But what we do is to produce all the conditions that lead towards that. And then it's like the snowflake that lands on the branch and is just the snowflake that is the heavyweight that breaks the branch. And there could be millions of other snowflakes there. They're all contributing to the weight on the branch, but there's just the last snowflake which breaks the branch. It's the same with our practice and the development of this true peace, that we have to just keep putting in the ingredients, but we never know when we're going to get that last ingredient which is going to be the breakthrough. And this is one of the traditional controversies in Buddhism, not so much in the Theravada school, but in some schools of the Mahayana, about whether it's possible to work towards enlightenment or enlightenment is just a sudden awakening. And when you hear about people having a sudden awakening, you have to recognize that they've probably put, well, certainly they've put in lots of other of effort in maybe other lifetimes to reach the point of ripeness where enlightenment happens very suddenly. So in the time of the Buddha, there were people who heard his teachings and became enlightened on the spot. But you have to recognize that they'd put in many, many lifetimes of work, just like the Buddha himself, to get to that point, to have the paramis of the merit, the goodness, to be born at the time when there was a Buddha that they could go and listen to, and to have the ripeness that they could give themselves completely to the teaching at that time, and through that be able to penetrate to the truth of what the Buddha was saying in that moment. So sudden enlightenment is the result of lots of hard work. Yes.
And I think in terms of the mind, that there is, but what we're striving for is a certain continuity rather than the permanence. We're actually striving or thinking for a continuity.
Yes. Yes, that's very true. The question or the comment that Ron's making is that although we talk a lot about impermanence, there's obviously continuity there too. And we see that there's impermanence in this body, but there's also continuity. And we're trying to develop the continuity in our mind that we head in the direction of goodness, of understanding. And this is quite true. In fact, I've given a talk here called Continuity in Impermanence. So this is something that we need to recognize, that we are planting seeds through our intentional thought, speech and action. And what this, another way of describing the spiritual life is to keep planting the right seeds so the right fruits grow, that is the fruits that lead to our peace and happiness and to our deeper understanding of life. And this is the continuity that we see and we recognize through the law of karma, of cause and effect, that the sort of seeds we plant in the, especially in the area of our moral choices, bear fruit, and that's the continuity. The understanding that is that we have, the wrong understanding that we have, is that there is no arising and ceasing, there is no change happening while there is that continuity. And one of the things that we understand when we're looking at impermanence is that there is the growth change that we see, but there's also this very subtle change that masks the fact that the continuity masks this subtle change. even while things are still existing, there is change happening in them. So while this body is still existing, there is change happening moment by moment, but there is continuity from birth to death. So we have to be aware of both. So we're concerned about the direction that the change goes in. Some change we can't alter the direction of, so for example from birth to death, but in the realm of our moral life, we can change the direction that that goes in. So I think if there are no more questions, I'll hand over to Sol for the announcements. Thank you.